on this week's triumphant return of Josh Nason's Punch-Out. We talk for the very first time ever to a five-time Jeopardy champion that also happens to be the former editor-in-chief for one of the most memorable websites of the MMA boom period, that being Ben Goldstein of the now-defunct Cage Potato. Ben recently completed his run on Jeopardy, and he's on to the Tournament of Champions, the date of which is now in flux due to the writer's strike. We talk about that. Ben and I talk for an hour on the rise and demise of Cage Potato back in the day, some of his fond memories and remembrances about that time in MMA journalism, including why he and the website went separate ways. It's a fun ride through the days for those that remember the site and remember, again, just a wild, wild time in MMA, especially UFC. Then we delve into his Jeopardy run, including how he got there, his experiences on the show, winning five times, dealing with Jeopardy Twitter, a little bit of controversy he created with some comments about travel, and also what's next for him. This was a great conversation about two completely separate worlds from someone that experienced them both at a very high level. So let's get right to my conversation with Ben Goldstein. I'm Josh Nason, and this is Josh Nason's Punch-Out. So for the very first time on this podcast, I have someone that's smarter than I am. You know, that doesn't happen that often, but
that's debatable.
Exactly. So worlds collide. So joining me at this time is Ben Goldstein. He is a five-time Jeopardy champion. He is also the co-founder of the now defunct Cage Potato, which was a very, very, very well-known, famous MMA site way back in the day, and that's how Ben and I got to know each other via Twitter and all that good stuff. So, of course, when all this hullabaloo started, when you went on this Jeopardy run, this had to happen. Ben, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Josh. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor.
Yeah, this is, we were just talking about this really briefly. What a year, what a run, right? This is crazy. You went from, you know, as I am and I've been in the past, just a normal, you know, working for a tech company, so to speak, you know, content guy, marketing, those type of things, you know, a traditional job. And all of a sudden, you're on TV, superstardom is awaited. You said you're walking around your small town and people are high-fiving you, getting pictures, selfies.
Still, even a month or so later, that's still happening. Trying to adapt to the life of a very minor celebrity in a small town. But it's amazing. Yeah. You know, like the towns, people around here are just more excited than I am. And it really, you know, puts a smile on my face every time someone says, hey, you're that guy from Jeopardy.
Yeah.
I am. Now I am. That's my major identity right now.
Yeah. So let's go back to the Cage Potato days. So,
yeah, sure.
Because obviously so much in MMA media has changed since that site was launched back in. When did it actually launch?
I want to say it was October 2007. I had just gotten laid off from a magazine job. I was working at a place called Stuff Magazine and sort of like looking for my next move. And then a friend of a friend who was working at a media company called Break Media at the time reached out to me and said, hey, I hear you're looking for a gig. I'm launching some websites out here in LA for this media company that would appeal to young men. We should talk. And then through the course of our conversations, we thought, hey, this MMA thing keeps growing and growing. Maybe we can bring a sort of like humorous men's magazine flavor, you know, like Maxim meets Deadspin, but for MMA and the UFC. That's where the idea came from. And then, yeah, it started in late 2007. And after a couple of years, it became a very well-known property.
Yeah, it's, I remember because it was much different than, and like you mentioned kind of intentionally, different than the traditional news MMA sites in that point, kind of more of a humorous take and not being so, you know, aggro serious where some of these, you know, other sites and obviously these fans are taking it.
Yes.
And it was interesting because, you know, a lot of fans, there was a good segment of fans that enjoyed that. You know, I think people typically see that what they assume to be an MMA fan then and probably even still now is a very, you kind of have the visual in your head, right? And then, but this is a much different, there was thinking MMA fans and people that are interested in this stuff and being like, this isn't, we don't have to take this so seriously, you know?
Exactly. So we definitely recognize that there was like a hole in the market for a sort of more of a humorous take on the sport. Fight Linker existed at the time, but you know, they had their own comic sensibilities. And I felt like myself and the other people who were there at the start had our own thing. So there was room for at least like one more, you know, funny mixed martial arts property. We found our sort of audience of like-minded people pretty quickly. But yeah, as you say, like there was still a pretty large swath of MMA fans that did not like humor in their MMA coverage. They still did kind of take it a little too seriously. And they just thought like what we were doing is silly. And what I sort of came to realize is there's just like this segment of humanity that just does not like fun. I don't know. There's no joy in their lives. Maybe they just, they don't like fun. And if there's any sort of connection I can make from like the Cage Potato days and the sort of my Jeopardy experience, like there's always going to be part of the fan base that does not like you stepping out of line, doing anything unserious, but you don't really have to pay attention to those people. Those are not your people. That's not the audience that I've certainly been shooting for my entire life.
Yeah. It's So you're going through this, obviously riding the boom period, you know, kind of the post Tough. So Tough One was at 2005, and they kind of just, mm-hmm. that's when everything just kind of started going, you know, up and to the right, so to speak. Correct. So you guys are riding high. You're doing well. I think I found a Google search. You're talking about like make, I think actually it's on your website now, like $85,000 a year at your max or something like that. Or
yeah.
And which back,
man, I did publish my salary at some point.
Exactly. Yeah. It was, but so I, you know, that stood out because for so many people that write for MMA websites and all stuff, a lot of it, it's a part-time thing because there weren't a lot of full-time jobs. And even for those people that are doing full-time jobs and have this, it's not, they don't make a lot of money. It's not like it's hard to make a living, you know, doing this stuff. So riding high and then kind of where, how did things, I won't say fall apart, but how did things kind of change and eventually, you know, you leaving the site and all that?
Yeah, well, let me just first address like that money issue. Like I think a lot of people in this, who sort of apply their lives to covering MMA, they sort of work independently or they have their own websites or have their own blogs or newsletters, and it's sort of on them to find a way to monetize that. It was a double-edged sword for us because we were owned by a large media property. And as I said, first it was Break Media, then it was Defy Media. And so that's good in the sense that, hey, it's up to them to figure out how to turn this thing into money. They had a great advertising network. People were paying them to put advertisements on their network of sites, including Cage Potato. We got to share a bit of that revenue. And sort of in the boom period, and as you said, the sort of post-Tough period through like, you know, 2009, 2010, into the Brock era, into the Ronda era, there was a lot of like advertising money being thrown around to be in front of these audiences of like UFC fans. So I was able to like work up to a really good salary just being like a functionary in that operation. The downside is, of course, when they decide, you know, the wind is blowing the other way and they want to pivot to video, or they feel like, you know, UFC is on downswing, it's not as hip anymore or something, then they start making cuts. And I eventually, I was laid off by the owners at the time, Defy Media. The company had changed hands. They wanted to go in different directions. They were sort of, in a more global sense or general sense, going away from like text-based blogs and more into social media, more into video, things like that. Who knows if it was a successful decision for them or not, but folks like me sort of got, you know, left holding the bag. I never owned Cage Potato. I was just the guy in charge of like running it from editor-in-chief perspective. So I think it was like early 2014, after, you know, our traffic had sort of flattened out. We were maybe pulling like 2 million visitors a month at our peak. And then it started to trickle down a little bit. And, our budgets got slashed. We had to let go of Mike Russell at one point, you know, as it was told to me, just because like we didn't have enough money to pay people like that. And unfortunately, I was eventually laid off too, maybe 7 or 8 years into my tenure over there. And it was a blow. It was like a professional blow at first, because I had spent like 7 or 8 years of my life like doing this one thing, had become very close to this community, and suddenly I didn't know what to do next necessarily. I was in a point where, you know, I could either still be a part of the MMA journalism, MMA coverage community, which I'd sort of been losing passion for. I started freelancing for entertainment sites. I was not making a lot of money. And it was kind of a rough patch. It was like that first half of 2014. It was very much, I had to reinvent myself professionally. What I came to the realization is at that point, I didn't love MMA fandom enough to continue to try to make a career out of it. And I decided to do something else. And that thing turned out to be content marketing for software companies, B2B software companies. And I got my first content marketing job in like, you know, the summer of, this is actually, this must have been 2015, not 2014. Summer of 2015. And I've sort of built a second career since then. And it's gone a lot better. It feels a lot more stable. And it's even more well-paying. So that's a good thing too.
Imagine that, right? Yeah. Yeah, that's what I've told people before, you know, they're like looking, try to get into this full-time or whatever. And I've always had the writing and all that stuff and podcasting as a secondary thing because as we're talking about, it's hard to make a living doing this. And some people really just want to pursue it and all that. And they have maybe have other means, or they just are willing to live on a lot less money and resource and things like that. But, you know,
having the primary job and then doing this as like a hobby seems to be the most common kind of framework for people covering the sport. Yeah.
Especially if you want like a house and you have a family to take care of and things like there's a lot of responsibilities, you know, when you get older and have
a life. Of course. And I think that's more like the sort of like unspoken element here is that when I was laid off, and lost control of Cage Potato, I had my 3-year-old son, and we had just bought our first house, two or three months prior to that. So suddenly like, oh, this is a problem. It's, you know, I have more financial responsibilities than I ever did before. And I'm now without a job and sort of at this crossroads. So I think, you know, I've sort of said this before, but like the prospect of having a much more dependable way to make a living was really attractive. And that sort of drew me away from first covering MMA professionally. And then ultimately sort of like, I got out of the habit of watching the fights. Yeah. And I barely consider myself an MMA fan these days.
Yeah. I want to ask about that, but first, how'd you first start to be an MMA fan? How'd you first kind of get on board with it?
I was like a martial arts fan for one reason or another, like when I was growing up in the '80s and, you know, by the end of that decade, you know, Bloodsport was a thing and watching Kickboxer. And I was watching these movies, maybe a little too young, with my dad. Always had like, you know, a warm spot in my heart for like martial arts. I thought it was the coolest thing. And then I think the first UFC fight I watched was UFC 3. I was probably like, you know, 13 or 14. And my friend Josh was like, hey, I'm getting this UFC pay-per-view thing. My parents let me like order this, and it's going to be like all the best martial artists from around the world like fighting together. And I'm like, this is like Bloodsport for real. This is like Street Fighter 2, but for real. Like I couldn't believe this was actually happening. And I remember just seeing like, it was such a spectacle. It wasn't exactly what I thought it was going to be. It was rougher and like less polished and real, you know, like seeing that, you know, sumo wrestler Attila Tuli get his tooth knocked out of his head by Gerard Gordeaux. Like, oh my God, this is like nothing I've ever seen before. And I just remember seeing, watching a bunch of those early pay-per-views with friends and then, sort of going on with my life for a while, but then getting back into it around the Tough era, around the, the first George St. Pierre, Matt Serra fight, that sort of like mid 2000s era. And then started like, it just picked it back and then it became a regular viewer. And, you know, 2 years after that, when that sort of acquaintance of mine said, hey, if you could start a mixed martial or a website that would sort of appeal to young men, what would it be about? And it immediately came to mind, like, we need to start another MMA property, but do it in a fun way.
Yeah. Yeah. I, very similar. Well, I watched one of the early ones on a going old school VHS tape that we rented from the local convenience
store.
Familiar
with those.
Yeah. And I, you know, I was like, I was big into pro wrestling at the time. And I'm like, it didn't do it for me at the time. I thought it was kind of boring. And then I remember I would get Dave Meltzer's Wrestling Observer newsletter from time to time, and I would skip right through all the UFC MMA stuff. I'm like, this is just so boring. I don't care. Fast forward to 2005, I got hooked in through Tough. I think like so many other people did, because it came after Raw, and it was, you know, so great showing off personalities and all that stuff as well. Yeah, I mean, everyone, you know, going through college, people knew who Tito Ortiz and Chuck Liddell was, played, you know, video game and stuff like that, but it wasn't like a pop culture thing. Then all of a sudden, you know, again, it just had this huge upswing. And then the thing that made it easier was where my friends were kind of into it. You know, they knew some of the names and they would get together and watch stuff. And I remember we had it might have been the Tough One finale. It might have been a watch party. Maybe it was the second one. But I mean, there was like, my friend was going to law school at the time. And it was like a bunch of like prospective lawyers and like a couple of their friends. There was like 15 of us in a room, like a Wednesday or Thursday night. And like now I mean, that doesn't happen. But then it was like young people were in it. There was girls and guys. It was just like, I still remember that. And like, that was kind of like, that was really cool. It was like a cultural thing.
Yeah.
So much has changed.
Getting together at the Buffalo Wild Wings with your friends and watching the pay-per-view used to be a thing, maybe more so look, I can't speak to this stuff objectively because I'm so out, like, you know, I'm a parent, I got two kids. I'm sort of like out of the game socially in a lot of ways. So like, I don't know what like 29-year-old men are doing with their time these days, but certainly when I was that age, it certainly felt like, yeah, you could just grab a bunch of dudes and just get together and watch the fights at someone's house or apartment or a bar. And like, it was just a fun thing to do. So that definitely helped make it more of a cultural moment, I think.
Yeah. So how old are you?
I'm 42.
42. Okay. So I'm 45. So a couple of years older. So right in that same range of, not knowing what the young lads are doing these days, except being on the phones. So you mentioned, you don't really pay attention to the sport at all now, right?
No, I mean, I think the only way I follow it is like, I still follow folks on Twitter like yourself that I used to follow back in the day when I was like, had my ear close to the ground. And, you know, obviously like Ben Folks and Chad Dundas, I'm still a huge fan of those guys. And there's a handful of other like news and personality accounts that I follow that could at least put like the major headlines or like, you know, GIFs or videos into my feed on Twitter. So like, I know that Jon Jones is the heavyweight champion now. I don't think I could tell you very many other champions that the UFC has, right? I'm just so far apart from it. Yeah. But yeah, once in a while, some headline or some fight recap or video will catch my eye and I'll be like, oh yeah, this is enough for me. Yeah. Watching this one head kick knockout is enough for me. And now I can go back to my normal life.
Yeah. I am very similar in that in the past, I think since the pandemic started, I've got more and more out of the sport in terms of care about it, mainly because, as you know, being a dad, so I have a 6-year-old, it is hard, and having a wife, it is hard to commit a Saturday night to sit and watch potentially 8 hours of a show and have to get up the next day. And then you have your parenting duties. Or if you're like, oh, I just can't stay up because, right, you know, 11 o'clock or so, whatever, you're starting like, wow, this main card is barely started. I can barely keep my eyes open. And then but you can't like sit and be like, sorry, family, I'm going to sit around and watch, you know, again, 5 hours the next morning while you guys do the daily stuff. It's just not a good way to keep this band on your finger, you know?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, man, you're bringing up a lot of like potential explanations or elements to why people, when they get a little older, kind of like come out of that fan base, the regular, like I'm on the East Coast. I think you are as well. Yes.
Yeah. New Hampshire.
So, like main cards for pay-per-views probably still start at 10 p.m. I imagine. And like, that's fine when you're a younger man, but it's exhausting when you're already sleep deprived from being a parent and you're not going to stay up until 1 and then have to get up. You know, my kids are up at 6 a.m. every day. Like, it just doesn't work. Like you said, the options are either sort of like add more sleep deprivation to your life or try to like catch up on it when you really should be, putting the focus on your family.
Exactly. Yeah. And also the proliferation of cards. Like it is when we were kind of really into it, you know, in that 05, 06, kind of that big rush, there wasn't a show every single Saturday. There was a show once a month. And then sometimes there was two a month. And we're like, oh my God, this is great. We get more, you know, stuff. So there was less people to follow and keep track of, right? Because, you know, the human brain, if you're taking all these different forms of entertainment, there's only so many things you can really, you know, that can really matter. And part of the fun of watching MMA back then was you had these contenders like, oh, I remember they fought 3 months ago. And then they're fighting. And it was at every 3 months or so cadence, right?
Yeah.
And then you'd be like, oh, I remember from here to here to here. And now they're getting a title shot or big opportunity. There was the promotions felt different. Like Strikeforce had a different feel to it than UFC did. WEC was a promotion that I think deserves more credit for what they did. That was just much different. And now it's just all, it's very much, I say very much corporate, but it's UFC one, you know, they're the major player in town by a long shot. Everything else just feels like a slog to get through. And UFC shows every Saturday, it's hard for stuff to seem special, you know, and that doesn't have that thing for me. I'm glad it does for a lot of people because the UFC is obviously doing great. But it's a content company now versus versus where we came from.
Yeah. And it has felt more homogenous for a while. And I think you're right. People who sort of were fans during the 2000s, that's absolutely one of the things they enjoyed was the sort of like, I'm going to watch, I can watch Pride if you came into it earlier, you know, early in your fandom enough, or UFC, WEC, Strikeforce, even like a little later, like You know, Elite XC, you know, the CBS fights with Kimbo, and like everything had a different flavor, and you could sort of the variety and diversity of presentation is what made it interesting. The variety of personalities, and this promotion had these rivalries, and this promotion had another, and gosh, you know, like what if the best champions fought each other, and now everybody's like looks the same, and it's just one big lump of clay, and mm-hmm. and you can't wear you know, your own sponsors on your shorts, right. And I think, you know, it almost seems silly to talk about aesthetics or visual presentation, but once like the fighters and the presentation started looking all the same, it takes the fun out of it. But also, like, that was one of the things that was appealing, is this sort of individuality. I think that's part of what appealed to like the earlier fans, is like, I want to be part of this kind of wild, colorful, unpredictable culture. You know, that's whatever, like it's cool to see guys fighting in a cage, but like I want to align myself and my identity with this kind of cool like punk rock thing that's going on. And now it's a lot more corporate, and there's so many fighters that maybe wouldn't have gotten a shot in the old days just mm-hmm. because of their experience or skill level. And it's a different experience for sure. You don't always feel like, you know, the importance of each individual bout has been lost, I think.
Yeah, yeah, because it felt like it meant something to get to the UFC at one point. Now it's there's with so many cards, it's like people get called on a week's notice, and yeah. It's just different. It's just different. Yeah, I kind of miss those old days. Final question about MMA before we shift to Jeopardy. Yeah. Do you have if you know, you're hanging around a campfire with some parents and things like that, or hanging out the, you know, local whatever. Mm-hmm. Is it, if they're just like, do you have a certain story that stands out about your MMA coverage run? Was there one thing that that immediately you're like, this is a story that I think would be good, that they'd like?
It's an interesting question, because like my assumption is that there's no MMA story that is going to appeal to like a non-MMA fan. But if they like, if you know, someone says, oh yeah, I used to watch UFC, or I still watch it, or this and that, I was like, yeah, I would tell them, like, I get to meet and interview a lot of those folks. And like, you remember Nick Diaz, he's kind of this crazy dude. Like, I remember interviewing him, and he was just so deadpan the whole time. I like couldn't get anything out of him. Mm-hmm. And I was like, Nick, I was sort of frustrated. I was like, Nick, what was the last thing? What's the last thing that made you laugh? And he said, what the fuck kind of stupid question is that? And that's when I knew that the interview was over. Yeah. And I was like, I'm going to leave while I still have all my body parts and faculties intact. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that. Like, obviously, like the whole, a lot of the Cage Potato vibe was sort of pushing the envelope a little bit, sticking the needle in a little bit, just to sort of take some of the seriousness out of it. And we talked earlier about how fans sometimes don't appreciate that. But of course, a lot of fighters don't appreciate that either.
Right.
You know, you're talking about their livelihood or their reputation, and you're like including some sort of like jab that's meant to be funny. Like Alistair Overeem like threatened to knee me in the nuts. Like it was like not person to person. It was more like he posted about it on a forum. It was like, when I see that guy from Cage Potato, I'm gonna drive my knee through his nutsack or something like that. A lot of threats like that from people who maybe just didn't appreciate the joke as much as me and our readers did. But that's sure. The name of the game.
Yeah, exactly. So let's flip to Jeopardy. So yeah, I had seen this. I'm not a regular Jeopardy watcher, but I obviously had been keeping track of your. I saw on Twitter that you were starting to go through the run, and I have a little bit of knowledge of this because last year I read Claire McKellar's book, Answers in the Form of Questions. Claire McNear.
Okay.
Answers in the Form of Questions, A Definitive History and Insider's Guide to Jeopardy. It was one of those things where I had heard her on a podcast. I'm like, this sounds interesting. And suddenly it's cool to read about stuff you had no idea about. And I read it, and I was fascinated about the subculture around Jeopardy, how contestants get there. Because I think, you know, so many people, it's just on TV. It's on TV every day. So it's just, you don't even think about kind of the machinations and all that stuff. So I was kind of interested about your story. Did you, because in the book, they talk about like the local trivia circuit, right? And different, not just the stuff necessarily in your bar, but like, there's just a whole thing about this and people quizzing each other in hotel rooms, these major things. How did you first kind of, we'll kind of rewind. How'd you first decide, like, and win that I want to try to get on this show?
I can tie this back to like a tweet I made in April 2015 where I was like, you know, studying for the Jeopardy Anytime test, and I just realized I don't know jack shit about anything. Like, it was something along those lines. But it's funny because like it's kind of the significance of that is that that was 3 months after I was fired from Cage Potato. So I think at that time I was just like looking for anything, any excuse to like fill my brain or pursue goals that like were new, have new things to shoot for. I had been a viewer of the show for a few years before that. And, you know, you get to a point where you start winning games off the couch. Hey, I would have won that game. If, you know, if I was there, I would have gotten, hey, I got that Final Jeopardy right. No one else did. Like, I think I would have won that game. And that sort of, I did not come from, you know, as you mentioned, the sort of trivia circuit, bar trivia, quiz bowl that people do when they're young. Like, I didn't do any of that stuff. I'd only been a fan of the show who has a sort of, I would say, like an above average recall ability for things that I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. MMA used to be one of those things. Of course, I can name it, every fighter, every bout, every, you know, card name, et cetera. Music, movies, same thing. And anything I like I have a mind like a steel trap. So yeah, I started at the time it was like 2015. You could take the online test like every year.
Right.
And I think they've changed. I think you can take like twice a year now, but like, yeah, I was taking the test once a year, kind of dutifully. And it took about 7 years for me to get a call back, but I my persistence paid off. Yeah. So I guess that's just to answer your first question. Like my trivia interest is really only Jeopardy interest. But I felt like I would have a good shot on the show and I started, you know, I took the test until they called on me.
Yeah. So you're going through that 7 year run and so to speak, and you're trying to get there. Are you, does the focus on trying to get on the show, did it change? Like, did you start trying to do more trivia nights and things like, and try to increase, or are you just kind of like doing the same thing you were doing all along and then just they happen to give you the call and away we go?
Yeah, I think in retrospect, I probably should have put more focus into the preparation and maybe it would have been a shorter, they would have, you know, taken me in 4 or 5 years instead of seven. But like, I didn't really, I would do some studying before each test I took in terms of like trying to shore up like weak areas of trivia. I'm going to run through the presidents again. Let me look at the world map. I'll look through like the list of, British royals and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I still, even while during that process, was not like let me join a quiz bowl team. And I think part of that was also like, hey, I'm a parent. Like my time outside of the house is limited. I'm going to save that for like going to concerts with friends or something like that.
Yeah.
So yeah, still didn't do any sort of organized trivia or really organized studying before the tests happened. So I don't know, I guess one piece of advice for anybody listening to this is like, maybe take it a little more seriously, make it like a usual part of your weekly routine to learn things that you're weak on when you're watching the show, and you'll probably have a better time actually being selected. Cause how it works is like, there's a 50 question test. This is like the first step, 50 question test. You have to score above a certain threshold. I've heard it said like 35 is the threshold. Someone said, I don't know how accurate that is, but like everybody who scores above that, there's like a random draw, like a random lottery system for people going to the next round of auditions, which is another test. And then a gameplay audition, which is like a personality test. Anyway, the point being like, even if you score well, as I did a couple times in my sort of lead up to, you know, in my quest to be on the show, like you might not get called. So you just kind of have to stick with it.
Yeah. Okay. So you go through the process and then finally you get the call. So tell me about that process. Like, so you finally did you actually get a call? Was it an email
the first was an email, and it's really just, hey, you've qualified to the next round of a live audition. And these things used to be different in the pre-COVID era. This was, you know, maybe like last summer when I got this, this email, and a lot of the production had changed due to COVID, where they were doing more things via Zoom. They used to do these things, a lot of these things live. You'd have to travel to the nearest big city and meet with some producer. But I was extremely excited. Like it was like the end of a, you know, it was like 7 years by that point. And I was like freaking out, forward the email to my parents and my wife. And I was just so thrilled that finally I think I might have a shot at this thing. So yeah, I was invited to a live audition, which is get on a Zoom call. I think that's how it will go on from now on. This is just the process now. And, you know, there's a bunch of other people on the call. A human being reads like 50 questions in a row. I think there's some system to entering, I think, a separate like window. You enter your questions, your answers. And then again, there's a certain threshold. And And if you score above it, then you are qualified to the next round. They may or may not pick you. But I remember during that sort of live test, I had a notepad and I was just like jotting down sort of very in shorthand, like the questions I think I blew. And again, having that number 35 in mind, I read somewhere a 35 is a threshold. And I think I got like 35 or 36 questions right. So like, I think I'm like, I'm barely good. I hope they call me. And that was, you know, that was like last summer. And then a couple months after that, I think it was in November, November, they gave me my, they emailed me again. And it was an invitation to a gameplay audition. This is a mock game of Jeopardy. So you get into a room with a bunch of people and they take you 3x3 on a Zoom call. And they run you through like a pretend game. And since it's like you're at home on a Zoom, you're like raising your thumb up and doing the clicking motion to signal that you know the answer. And then they call on you. But the questions are easier. They just want to see how people react, how aggressive they are. Knowledge is like part of it, but they want to see that you would be personable on TV. So yeah. Then they do like, you know, what do you do for a living? And if you want a lot of money, what would you do with it? And, you know, when you're not working, what do you do for fun? And like some people had good answers to that stuff. And I think I had some good answers. I was making people laugh, and some people like did not have good answers to those questions. Right. And I really think that was the difference. That's that, like, they're not trying to see how you play Jeopardy. They want to see how you would be on television. And that's a much better piece of advice for people, you know, going on the show. If you get to that point, it's a personality test. Okay. It's not a trivia test. You have to pretend to be charming. Yeah. And try to, make an impression with the people who are running the audition.
Yeah. That was one of the other things that I remember from the book was, to that point, it's a TV show, you know. Yeah. It's not just, you know, typical people that aren't going to have, you want the viewer to have some sort of connection, emotion when you win, to connect, you know, and yeah, kind of just keep going. And we see, you know, pop culture wise, if people go on long runs, it becomes kind of this thing in the culture. People start to kind of get, oh, I know that person. Yes. And then, you know, they connect onto them in some, you know, some form or fashion. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you get through all this and then you get the call.
Then they do call.
Okay. Then they do call. Tell me about that moment.
I'm for some reason, I never have my phone on. It's either on vibrate or just silent. Cause what important person's going to call me, right? It's all scam likely.
I know.
I don't want to be disturbed at work. And I remember I was like, I think I was like picking up dinner or like for my family or something. This is like right after finished work. And I was just checking my emails, after I parked the car, and it was like, hey Ben, this is so-and-so from Jeopardy. We just tried to call you, email me back. Like the implication was they were going to offer me a spot to tape an episode. So I was freaking out in my car, called them back right away, got voicemail. You know, I was like, oh God, I hope this was not the chance that I missed.
Right.
Emailed them back. And I was like, hey, I just so sorry. And of course, like I don't have my voicemail set up either. So it's really like, they're calling a black hole. I was like, it isn't, you do have the right number, I promise. Like, sorry, my ringer's off, voicemail's not set up, but please, hey, let me know when you're available and I'll call you back then. So yeah, we did connect after a little bit of phone tag that day. And it was one of the producers from the show who's just like, you did great in the audition and we'd love to have you at a taping on April 4th. Can you make it here? And without even thinking, I was like, yeah, of course. I would have dropped anything pretty much.
Yeah.
I got that call like late February. So it was about 5 weeks of lead time between the call and me flying down to LA to tape my first episode.
Man. All right. Yeah. So you fly out there. Of course, you mm-hmm. have all the thoughts going through your head, I'm sure. And did you do kind of did you try to like bone up on certain subjects and things like, and when you mentioned like, you know, I'm looking at US presidents and geography and things like that, there are so many things that they could fucking ask on the show. Right. I mean, I don't even know how you begin to say, I'm going to focus on this or this or this. Cause you know, they could throw you a curveball and you're like, I have no idea about Egyptian history from 1632 or something, you know?
Well, so yes and no. Like, okay. Yeah, the sort of range of knowledge that you have to sort of have a handle on is very, very broad, of course. But if you watch a show a long time, you know, like it tends to be the same questions a lot. And like Egyptian history from X to X, like they're going to ask about two or three rulers of Egypt or, you know, they're three or four of the main gods in Egyptian culture. And it's not like they don't take the deep cuts very much.
Yeah.
It's generally the same one. So what I decided was, as soon as I got the call, I started cramming. What that meant to me was I'm going to go to, I found a website. There's a couple websites out there that are sort of similar, but trivialstudies.com/Jeopardy. It has, is a storehouse of every question that's ever been asked on the show. And it's divided by category and you can randomize it in like flashcard form. And that's what I did for a month straight, was go on the site, pick a category, science, philosophy, books and authors, something like that. And just like drill flashcards randomly. Because, and I still feel that's the, probably the best way to prepare for the show, because you do see so much repeat questions and it does get you in that mind frame of like, I don't want to call it a mile wide and an inch deep, but like the best known items, people, places, things from a broad assortment of categories. As long as you know, like the most well-known things that could potentially come up, you'd be in really good shape. And from that point, it's just a matter of like remembering it all. Like this, the stuff I studied, it was a lot of it like appeared on the show, honestly. It's just like, could I recall it in the moment was more of the question. So I think the only regret I had in my preparation process was not starting preparing right after the gameplay audition back in November. Cause I felt like I nailed it. I was like, I made the producers laugh. I feel like I had a better personality than a lot of people who were in the room with me. I'm sure they'll call me sooner or later. And 3 months later, they did. I should have spent that 3 months preparing instead of just like waiting for the call. But it obviously worked out. You know, everything went fine.
Yeah. So talk to me about the buzzer, because this is a big thing in the book as well. The buzzer prep and how, and that is such a major part of it. Talk to me about the buzzer and how you prepared, kind of the tricks you learned. And this, again, it's your brain is telling you like, I know this, and clicking. And talk to me about that and how that worked.
So one thing I did do after my gameplay audition was order the book Secrets of the Buzzer by Fritz Holtznagel, which came out a few years ago. And that's, you know, it's been described as like the Bible for buzzing on Jeopardy. And there's a lot of great tips. Like I'm really glad I put in the time. It's a short book, but like there's advice on how to hold your hands when you're holding the buzzer, what the process is like in terms of, hey, the host reads a question, then someone off camera, like, arms the buzzers by clicking a button, and then lights appear on the sides of the screen, and then you buzz.
Right.
Like just knowing that sort of flow, it definitely gave me a leg up from people who maybe came in cold and just didn't really know how the buzzer works or when you can buzz in. Obviously, you know, for people who are sort of not clued in on this stuff, like if you buzz in too early, you get like penalized a quarter of a second, which is a lifetime up there on the stage. And of course, like if you're buzzing in too late, if your like reaction time is off, you're not going to do well in the show. They do give you a practice session before they start recording. And I realized right away, hey, I'm actually pretty good at this buzzer thing. Like what I had, the point of view that I'd come in with for the recording was like, I'm going to wait for the host to read the question. As soon as that last syllable sort of like rings out, that's when the buzzers are going to come out. So that's when I'm ring in. I'm not going to wait for the lights to come on and then try to make it a visual reaction game. I'm 42. I haven't been a gamer in a long time. Like, yeah. I don't think I would win that contest. So I'm trying to time it by when the question is finished being read, boom, that's when you ring in. That worked pretty well for me. I was doing what a lot of people do before my taping session, which is I was using a click pen on the sofa and watching the games and trying to sort of match that timing. And, you know, one thing you could do is try to match that timing to when they, if you're watching the show, from the question appearing on the screen to like the, you know, it cuts to the contestants, like that moment, that cut in the TV production, that's about when the lights come on for the contestants. If you're practicing, that's when you want to time it to, pretty much, more or less. But I feel like I did all the preparation I could on the buzzer, and it turned out I was pretty good on it. And, you know, they have statistical box scores on Jeopardy.com. My rate of successful buzzes on attempts was like around 70%, which is not just above average, but like elite level. So like that was my advantage, because I'm not a trivia genius by any measure, but I was able to buzz in well and make some good wagers and play the game maybe better than some of my contestants, my opponents.
Take that, Alistair Overeem.
And I could have passed a drug test too.
Exactly. All right. So you get the opportunity. Of course, you said it was April that you started, right? You got flown out there, and
I flew out on my own dime.
That's right. Yeah,
which became sort of a flashpoint.
I want to ask about that in just a minute. So you had you flew out there, and so if I remember right from the book, basically everyone kind of gets brought, and you're sitting. The potential contestants just kind of sit and watch the other games, and eventually you know when you're going to get called, right? And then
before you let you know before your game starts.
Right.
So when you show up in this, you know, bullpen, it's like you're being led two by two to the stage. You don't know which game you're going to play. So go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. So how much lead time did you have before getting the call, so to speak?
Very little, like minutes. The producer will come and say, you guys are up next and you have time to like use the bathroom. And then they lead you out to the stage.
And
so, the green room, I think they still do it this way, or they will for a while. It's like we were in the Wheel of Fortune set on Sony Picture Studios entertainment lots.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's where we were hanging out, and like the studio audience spot for Wheel of Fortune, it was a big tarp over the wheel. We couldn't touch it. Oh, well. But yeah, so it works out. You know, they tape 5 episodes a day. They tape 2 days a week. So that week they taped on Monday and Tuesday, and I was flown out, or I went there. I was invited out for the Tuesday game. So second day of the week, they don't call me the first game. They don't call me the second game. They don't call me the third game. There's a long lunch break. They don't call me the fourth game. So I was the last game of the taping week. So, it was a lot of like, you know, not to compare myself to a UFC fighter, but like there's the sort of adrenaline dump element of like you come in real hot and you have that sort of layer of sweat on you and you're ready to go. And then you're sort of being iced all day long. And, you know, a lot of people also talk about that long lunch break, how that sort of like takes the heart out of people because you sit down and you get comfortable and then you can't snap back into like focus mode.
Yeah.
Another sort of thing I've mentioned, I think just to friends, was like, you know, you're in this green room with a lot of smart people, and we're watching the games as they go by on the monitors. And some of the people like seem to know the answers to every single question. So the thing you have to avoid is like being psyched out. Mm-hmm. I was terrified of this one guy who I was like, please don't let me face this guy. He knows everything. And he actually went on the game before me and got in the third place. And I think he was smart enough. I think he just didn't figure out the buzzer or something like that. But like, right. You never can tell. Anyway, so it was the first, the last game of the taping week, snuck by through a weird wagering mishap. And then I had like 5 or 6 days to just fly back home and kind of think about things, and which turned out to be really, really fortunate.
Okay. So you get home, and then, so you win the first game, you get sent home, and then you have to come back.
Yeah. So the next taping days were like Thursday and Friday. So gotcha. I had to be there. Well, I had to be there the day before for like a COVID test, which I think they just stopped doing. But the taping day was Thursday. But in that time, you know, like I went back to here to the Ann Arbor, Michigan area. I live in Dexter, and got to have the confidence of like walking around thinking I am the reigning Jeopardy champion. Nobody around me knows that. I can't tell anybody.
Yeah, you can't say a word about it.
Can't say a word. Well, you know, okay. I told my wife was there, and you know, I told my parents, okay, but that was about it. But yeah, it was that plus thinking, oh goodness, I was in second place in my first game, lost, you know, didn't get the final Jeopardy question correct and still won the game. How do I avoid this sort of wagering, maybe error, maybe just like a non-ideal approach that the other person in my game made? So I started thinking about wagering strategy a lot in that week leading up to my next, you know, tape day. And that was super helpful because I just never thought about it very much up until that point. And it's such a huge element of the game. The trivia is what it is. And I knew I was good in the buzzer, but like wagering could just like swing a game so dramatically. And I started like I did like all my cram sessions on that, not trivia in that week between my first game and games 2 to 6.
Yeah. The game within the game with the buzzer and the wagering and all that stuff. Yeah. So you go out and then you go in a run. So you go out for Thursday. Mm-hmm. So Thursday, Friday, you win.
So it was Thursday because it turned out, well, like I said, they tape 5 games in a day. I won the second, third, fourth, fifth games. So that was like the first 4 games they taped that day. And I lost the last game of that taping day. So it was just Thursday, but it was 5 games. And I was like on my feet the whole day. It was just an insanely like emotionally and physically harrowing experience, but like exhilarating.
Yeah.
And if I had won that last game, I think I had enough juice left to like do it again the next day, but it didn't work out that way.
Yeah. So that's fascinating. Cause so many people, they see it, they figure that it's taped every day or, you know,
right.
because you watch one off a day.
Yeah.
But as you mentioned, you're on your feet all day and your brain is constantly, you have to be on for the whole day. You talked about where you came in from the challenger position. So then you become the reigning defending champion, right? And so how does your mentality change, or does it change as you go through day again, taping by taping during that day, and how'd you manage that?
There was such wild swings between like, I'm the smartest person on earth, and like, I suck. Like, what am I even doing here? That just like, it just sort of flipped throughout the day. I'll tell you that after that first game, you know, the first time on like April 4th or whatever, like, even though like my performance wasn't that great, like I was leading most of the game and, you know, found a way to win at the end. And that actually gave me a ton of confidence thinking, hey, even if the questions aren't my, you know, cup of tea, even if Final Jeopardy doesn't go right, like I can find a way to win. I could beat anybody. And especially just like thinking about wagering more, I came into that second taping day, game two for me, with a tremendous amount of confidence. I was like, no matter what happens, I'm going to win this game. I have advantages over these other people who have not been on the stage before. I know what it's like. And so that was maybe one of the high points of my confidence, just thinking like, I've seen it all before. I'm going to clean the floor with these other two people. And I did win. And I won that game and I won my next game, but they weren't very dramatic. You know, there were low scoring games. And I think by the end of that third game, which is a really tough board for everybody, the confidence started to slip a little bit. It was like, if someone comes in and like puts up a big score, like I'm going to get buried out there, and I'm not doing excellent in any of these games. But then, you know, I got a runaway victory. I got that last game, where like I won by $5 out of the sort of tricky wager. And I started feeling again, like theoretically I could beat anybody here. Like I'm not afraid of anybody. Any sort of imposter syndrome I had from not being on the quiz bowl team in high school disappeared due to the sheer fact of like, I'm winning games and these people aren't. So, at the end of the day, I felt pretty confident up there.
Yeah. So you're going, so you win, so you, five games, you get again beat. You head back to Michigan, and then it's a case of the waiting game until the episodes air, which was my time frame is all messed up. It was earlier this month, right? Was it June?
No, it was June. The first one aired like June 19th.
Okay.
So and the last one aired like a week after that. So it was like late June.
Got it. So you're on all over the world, all over the country, people getting to know. And then what I really enjoyed about the run was your Twitter game. Because you were, I want to say not humble, but you were very confident. I want to say antagonistic in a good way.
Yeah.
And it was like you were having fun with it. And I think that really kind of added a fun level to it, especially for those people that are familiar with and know you, where you just, you weren't like being just kind of like happy to be here. You were just kind of like, oh, I'm going to win this thing, you know? And like, just your personality? It has to be, right? I mean, just to be like, to have some fun with this and being like, come on, haters, let's go.
Yeah. So I think I've sort of developed this online personality from the Cage Potato days of, you know, just being kind of a little bit of a dick, but just like trying to, you know, create a good time out there. I'm trying to create fun for people. And I wanted to treat it like a competition. You know, maybe a lot of my MMA influences are sort of leaking out in weird ways that I didn't even see coming. But you know, it was almost surprising when I heard, you know, someone say like he's trying to be an asshole out there or something. I was like, well, that's not really the main goal. Is just like make it exciting.
Yeah.
And I want to, the whole Chris Pannullo call out. It's not because I think I'm awesome. It's because I'm trying to create a rival. I'm trying to create heat for this show that we all want to watch. And again, like that's the moment where I definitely realize, oh yeah, there's a lot of these people who don't like that whatsoever.
Yeah.
They don't understand heat. They don't want, you know, people calling each other out. They're just in it for the trivia. And you know, I'm sorry. Those are just not my kind of people.
Yeah.
But it was a blast, like sort of tweeting through that first week when I was appearing on the show, because I knew it was going to happen. I could sort of drop, you know, subtle hints. You can't do any spoilers or they'll try to withhold your money. But I wanted to be a personality because I think that's fun when I see it on the show. I love James Holzhauer, like, and I like how the show has become looser since Alex's passing. Like, you know, there's more like crosstalk between the hosts and the guests and between the guests. Like, that's fun for me. I it's too bad if not everybody likes it, but I love when contestants have a personality, and I wanted to have a personality as well.
Yeah. So Jeopardy Twitter must be a thing. As they're interacting with people. What did you, what were you hearing from the Legion of Jeopardy fans? I'm sure some loved you. And again, to your point, some may have been like hoping that you lost.
Yeah. I would think, you know, most of online comments are negative. It's the worst is like if they excerpted something I did on like their YouTube channel or the Instagram channel, like 80% would be negative. Like, who is this clown? You know, like the only thing that really bothered me when was like someone was like, God, his stories are so boring. And I'm like, no, they're not. They're really interesting. It's like it's just a difference of taste that you can't convince. You can't convince people to be on your side of like, no, this is interesting. This is fun. It's like people, you know, some people just don't get it. So, you know, certainly from the Cage Potato days, I've developed a thin skin in terms of like dealing with the haters online. It doesn't really bother me very much, but I've absolutely tried to focus on the people who did like what I was kind of flying up the flagpole and did appreciate the fun moments and the sort of intro bits and all that stuff. And, you know, those are my people, everybody else, whatever. You don't have, it's a free show. You don't have to watch it. You certainly don't have to like me.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you go through the run again, you qualified for the Tournament of Champions, which do we even know at this point when that is?
We do not. I just saw a story on Variety, a Jeopardy.
I was going to ask producer. You about this. Yeah.
So they just released a statement that said that they will not film or produce the Tournament of Champions until the WGA and SAG-AFTRA strikes are settled, mostly because they want to write new material for those tournaments. But the sort of weird wrinkle in that story is that like they do still at this point plan on filming regular games in the coming months after this hiatus with old previously used questions, which of course a lot of fans, including myself, are kind of upset about. But yeah, the sort of announcement came on the heels of Ray LaLonde, who won 13 games earlier this year, saying, hey, I'm not going to be a part of this thing, the Tournament of Champions, because, you know, in solidarity for the unions. And then, you know, Ben Chan and Hannah Wilson said, yeah, me too. If you're not there, I'm not doing it as well. I think that's the right position to take. You know, I don't know what else to say. It's like the writers are the ones who create the show. It's a bunch of questions written on a board. I don't know what we can say. And like, if you sort of dig into what these folks are striking about, it seems like we just need to give them what they want, because what they're doing is striking against exploitation by you know, studios and broadcast networks and things like that. Anyway, the point being, we got to sit on our hands for a while, because this thing is not going to come together until those strikes are settled.
Yeah, get sit on your buzzers for a while, I guess.
Yes, right. So practice at home.
Exactly. So probably at this point, 2024 is, I would assume, because this strike
thing
gonna last for a while.
Yeah, because the original timeline was we're going to film this in early fall and it'll be like aired in late fall. Well, you know, we've already been pushed out a couple months from like regular schedule, I feel. So I would imagine, I don't know when it's going to be taped, but yeah, I would imagine it would be airing like early to mid 2024.
Got it. And in terms of, so one other thing you alluded to earlier, another controversy, this is great. Controversy creates cash, right? The travel expenses. So as you were mentioning earlier, so as I had learned through reading some stuff, searches and everything, that you have to pay your own travel out there for your first for your first game. That includes hotel, transportation, meals, all that. So basically that's the deal. And then after, if they call you back, if you keep winning, then they cover expenses after that.
They cover your flight. That's it. Yeah.
So for a major game show that makes a lot of money, it's been around for decades upon decades upon decades, and you know, it's just really just paying talent, and that's about it, plus prize money. Seems to be kind of a head scratcher from the outside. No,
yeah, it is. And look, I never intended for this to be like my crusade. I will tell you, like, this is like the strangest element of my entire Jeopardy experience, is being turned into clickbait and being taken out of context by like low quality media. Right,
the circle just comes around.
Yeah. Like, man, yeah, now I get it. No, I mean, whatever. We were never clickbait people at Cage Potato. But yeah, the point was, I think the Jeopardy fan on Twitter was, they posted an article about basically Jeopardy's position on not paying expenses. And I just, you know, I quote tweeted it, and I was like, by the way, I think, you know, this is an interesting discussion. And I think it would open up the game to a more diverse, socioeconomically diverse range of contestants. Yeah. If you're saying, hey, you don't have to pay your own way and make it a potential monetary loss by going on the show, you know, just pay flight and a hotel, like, you know, have a shuttle bus, collect people from an official hotel and take them to the studio. There's a lot of like Ubering I had to do. And I think I still think it's the right opinion. It's a good opinion. Don't yell at me for having a good opinion.
Yeah.
But what made it kind of blown out is like bloggers taking that and be like, Ben Goldstein blasts Jeopardy for not paying his travel expenses. And of course, like people, some people only read the headlines and they don't, you know, they don't care to look into the context. So that got me some criticism online. But yeah, a lot of like tabloid style stuff was just like, it was me criticizing the show. And I was like, I'm just trying to offer some advice here to a show we all love. And just trying to raise some questions here.
Yeah.
Still stand by it, you know, but I just don't like how that was me blasting the show because it really wasn't.
Yeah. Cause there are, to your point, there are people from different cultures, different, you know, no matter skin color, any of that type of stuff, their economic situation is that they may not have, you know, $5,000, $4,000 kicking around for a flight, hotel and things like that. But they may be just as smart, if not smarter and more qualified. And they've been practicing their whole life. But they don't have the means to get there. So how does a multi-million dollar show, how does it open things up? It seems like a no-brainer, right? No pun intended.
Yeah. Look, you know, you will lose money on the show if you do not win a game. And that's just something we all got to live with. And it would be nice. It really, like a flight... not even a nonstop flight from somewhere in the Midwest or the East Coast and like two nights at a hotel, you're not adding a ton to the budget for each episode. So, and I personally think it's the right thing to do, but like, again, this is just a random thought I had one day and, you know, not trying to make this my whole identity.
Exactly.
Love the show. Yeah.
Good stuff. So what's next? We're waiting on the Tournament of Champions.
Yeah.
And then once that is done, we'll see how that goes. Is it a case of, I mean, your Jeopardy run is done, or other ideas, or how? I can't remember if you can actually get back on after you've been a champion, or
there have been times where like I think would require me winning this tournament, which like I'm a huge underdog. Mm-hmm. I understand that, but people who have won these you know, annual tournaments of champions, they could get invited back to like a tournament of the decades. Other opportunities can arise, you know, like I think of a guy like Buzzy Cohen, who won 9 games and he won a tournament of champions. And now he's like the host of their official podcast. There are sort of opportunities that arise from being like a notable face in this Jeopardy community. I think anything like that happening to me would require me to not just like do well, but like having an amazing performance in this tournament when it comes along, like really, really just shifting the narrative from like, I got lucky a few times, to like, damn, this guy's really good. So we'll see. I'm not putting any of my eggs in that basket. Yeah. I'm just trying to study as much as I can and overperform in this Tournament of Champions, just like I overperformed during the regular season run.
Yeah. So what else is next for you?
What else is next? I don't know. I got a new job at the end of May. Again, content marketing. I'm the director of content marketing for a company called Vitally. It's a customer service platform. Excuse me, customer success software platform. Just trying to like have success in sort of this sort of second life I've had as a content leader. That's my professional focus right now. And yes, it's pretty much just that, raising my kids and kind of studying trivia to be ready when the call does come.
Yeah. So final question. I know you were asked by the, I watched your post-show taping interview on the Jeopardy website. I watched that the other day. Mm-hmm. And they asked what you're going to do with all your winnings. I believe your total take pre-taxes was $50,000.
About 50, yeah.
Yeah, about 50. So take away taxes and all that. How's the basement coming along? Is that what we're looking at now?
Yeah, you know, every little bit helps, right? We were planning on sort of like moving to our forever home, so to speak, next year anyway. So I'm sure it'll be helpful, but you know, fun fact and not so fun fact is like they take up to 120 days to send you your check after, and this is kind of standard practice for most television productions. But so like the money has not actually arrived yet.
Oh, I see. Yes.
So we are not spending like crazy over here.
Yeah.
And you know, 50,000, I'm not going to turn my nose up in that. It is of course the lowest total for a 5-day champion since they doubled scores back in 2001. Love to be in the history books in one way or another. But yeah, I just hoped to win at least that much in the tournament. They give you 50,000 for coming in third place. Okay. So that is my target.
I like the $50,000 man. I like it.
Yeah.
I mean, as you mentioned, living in a small town, I mean, the waiters and so like that, you got to be careful what you tip. They're like, oh, this would a Jeopardy championship.
About that. Believe me, it's weird. It's weird. I do try to over tip a little bit these days. Just in case, you know, people recognize who I am, and most people around here seem to at least know my face.
The weight of fame has finally come upon the shoulders. Well, Ben, this has been a fascinating talk about the MMA, the way things used to be, and also Jeopardy. I was fascinated by your story, and I'm glad we were able to finally connect and do this.
Ben, I am too, Josh.
Also, where people follow you on Twitter, Goldstein Raw.
That's right.
And
GoldSteen Raw. That's right.
Where else? Anything else?
It sounds boring as hell, but I've been on LinkedIn a lot recently just for like work related stuff. So if you care about marketing at all, or even just like writing and editing, and you're on LinkedIn, you know, connect with me, just search for Ben Goldstein. You'll see my face. Always happy to connect and talk shop about writing and marketing.
Good stuff. All right, Ben, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Josh. It was great. Great time. Take care.
All right. Big thanks to Ben Goldstein for dropping by. That was a conversation that I was glad to make it happen. I don't think he's done a lot of interviews with websites like ours, so I was glad to do that, and hopefully some of the old school MMA people that remember Cage Potato get a kick out of that. I did. I thought it was a lot of fun. And that book, I would recommend that book I referenced at the top of the show to anyone. I'm not a Jeopardy fan per se, but I thought that book was super interesting and kind of just these inside details about how things come together, the show that's been an institution on TV for decades. A couple questions I forgot to ask Ben. One was, did he miss out on not having the full Alex Trebek experience? He referenced how the game changed after Trebek passed away. But, you know, does that mean, did he actually want to kind of experience that? Again, another TV institution in Alex Trebek. So forgot to ask him about that. And also, I did not give him a shout out for his homage to Mike Tyson's Punch Out, which he did on the show. I believe after he won his first game, he did kind of the Glass Joe uppercut swing, if you're familiar with the video game. And I forgot to ask him about that. Given that the show is Josh Nason's Punch Out, I should have asked him about Mike Tyson's Punch Out and all the good stuff, perhaps for another time. So again, big thanks to Ben. Thanks to all you for listening. Good shows coming up the next couple weeks. Next week, lining something up that should be fun, especially for people that have been longtime website subscribers. If I can make this happen for next week, 2 weeks from now, Brandon Thurston's going to return. And Brandon and I are going to do our second AEW investors call, so to speak, covering the second 3 months of the year, be April, May, and June, kind of like we did our first one, going deep, deep, deep into AEW business like no one other can. Brandon does a great job over there at WrestleNomics, so happy to have him come back for the second round. And yeah, good fun stuff coming up, and that's it. Again, you have a lot of choice in your podcast day, so I greatly appreciate the time you spend with me or any of the fine podcast hosts here at WrestlingObserver.com. Until next time, insert catchphrase here.